You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
What a beautiful day for horses in the morning.
You are listening to the number one horse podcast in the world. Here's your entertaining look at the horse world and the people in it.
I'm Julie Broadway, president of the American Horse Council.
And I'm Emily Stearns, health, welfare, and regulatory affairs liaison for the American Horse Council.
And you are listening to the special monthly American Horse Council episode of Horses in the Morning on the Horse Radio Network for March of 2026.
It's time to hear from the American Horse Council in this monthly episode of Horses in the Morning.
Today, we're talking about something every horse owner depends upon and their horses depend upon, which is hoof care and the role of the farrier. Whether you ride for pleasure, competition, or just enjoying having your horses at home, a good farrier is one of the most important partners in your horse's health. Understanding what they do gives you a huge advantage as an owner and a rider.
And we all know the old saying, no hoof, no horse. And it's blunt, but it's true. But a horse with poor hoof care can't perform, stay sound, or even stay comfortable. And a good farrier keeps your horse moving well and helps prevent small issues from kind of becoming big ones. And honestly, many owners don't realize just how much science and skill goes into farriery until they've had a horse with a problem.
Exactly. People sometimes think it's just the trimming and putting on the shoes, but it's really about biomechanics and balance and movement analysis, and sometimes a bit of horse psychology, too.
And human psychology. So farriers manage nervous horses, anxious owners, tight schedules, weather that never cooperates. I was watching my farrier out in the sub-zero temperatures last week. They deserve honorary degrees in logistics management.
Indeed. Every horse person also has had at least one farrier story that they like to recount. Usually it's involving mud. A horse that suddenly forgets how to pick up its feet, has a lapse in memory, or that moment you realize your horse has been standing on the lead rope for 10 minutes.
Or my horse that likes to give kisses on the butt, maybe with his teeth, while the farrier is doing his feet. So there's horses that are perfect all year until the farrier truck pulls in, and suddenly it's like that Olympic-level event.
It's amazing how that happens. I don't understand how horses can distinguish the sound of the farrier's truck from every other truck that pulls into the yard, but somehow they manage to do that. But speaking of Olympic level, did you know that Grant Moon is widely regarded as the best known farrier in the world, thanks to his 6-time world championships and his global teaching presence? I believe when I looked this up, he has shod horses in multiple countries, like 3+ kind of countries. He's like the renowned farrier across the globe.
And, you know, there really is a competition for everything at this point, but it would be really cool to go to the farrier championships. So it just, again, really highlights how it's both a trade and a profession with kind of elite levels of mastery. And really, the best farriers combine craftsmanship and veterinary collaboration and ongoing continuing education, because every horse is different and there's different conformation and different movement and workload and needs.
Well, and I'm just going to add one other little skill set to that, Emily, which is I think they have to be extremely innovative. Every horse is unique, and sometimes that means they have to get really creative with what the solution looks like. And that's why today's conversation is so valuable. Whether you are new to horses or you have owned horses for decades, understanding your farrier's role will help you be a better partner to your horse's care. So today's episode is brought to you by Smart Equine. Smart Equine is here to help you bring out the best and the performance of your horse. We empower trainers, barn managers, and other industry professionals to help their horses thrive with expertly formulated supplements and thoughtfully designed wellness products. Backed by veterinarians and top trainers alike, they blend science and real-world horsemanship for consistent results that you can count on. Whether your goals are to train for a competition or to support the horses you know and love, you can count on Smart Equine to support you every step of the way. Very appropriate that we're talking about farriers every step of the way, with one-of-a-kind solutions to meet each and every horse's unique needs.
So today I want to welcome Martha Jones and Travis Burns. Martha, take a minute, introduce yourself and the America Farriers Association.
Okay, thank you, Emily. My name is Martha Jones. As you said, I'm the executive director of the AFA. And the AFA is an organization made up of primarily farriers, both here in the U.S., in Canada, in Mexico, and in another 14 countries outside of the U.S. And again, we're made up of farriers, some veterinarians, some associates, certainly student farriers, etc. And we exist to, as we say, set the standard of excellence in hoof care. So our primary purpose is farrier certification, which I believe we'll talk about a little bit later. And then, of course, continuing ed, educational resources via videos, print items, and so forth. So that's our role in the industry.
Awesome. Welcome. Travis, take a minute and introduce yourself, please.
Great. Thank you for having me. My name is Travis Burns, and I'm a farrier in Blacksburg, Virginia. I work at the Virginia Maryland College of Veterinary Medicine, and I'm proud to be a member of the AFA and have been for many, many years. And I'd say it's probably the single most important thing in my career was finding the AFA, finding the education, finding the opportunities, and finding that network of farriers.
So, guys, we often hear from people they have such a difficult time finding a farrier. So my first question, Martha, is how many farriers are there in the U.S.?
I think that number would probably surprise you. It's also a little bit of a moving target, but, you know, we hear there's anywhere between around 27,000 to 30,000 at any given point. Of course, again, moving target as we have students entering the field and then we have people retiring, but there's really quite a few more than your audience might realize.
Wow.
That's a lot more. Yeah.
A lot more. My eyes are rolling in my head right now. So the question then, that's my follow-up before I jump to the next thing is, so how do people find farriers? I mean, is there like a directory? Can they come to your website? Because when they say to us, I can't find a farrier, what do we tell them to do?
Well, we always recommend that they do visit the AFA website, AmericanFarriers.org, and there is a tool on our website called Find a Farrier. You can use that to enter by your geographical location. Certainly, if you've been given a name and you want to find out if that farrier is credentialed, you can use it as a tool there as well. So that's a really great resource. And of course, it's always a lot of word of mouth that happens. I'm sure you all know with in the industry, it's word of mouth, and the really good farriers, I mean, they are really busy in general.
Yeah, indeed.
So in terms of the AFA, if we have about, you think there's about 27,000 farriers out there, how many are AFA members?
A very tiny portion of those. We are somewhere between at any given point 2,200 and 2,500, which tells you how few really are out there as part of the association, which also kind of speaks to a lack of regulation in the profession, I believe.
So what does the AFA work to do in terms of professionalizing farriers?
That's a great question. So sort of the jewel in our crown, as we've always considered it, is our certification program. We believe that really does set a standard for hoof care. We do not say that it's the be-all and end-all. And in fact, we strongly encourage farriers that once they go through certification to continue with their education, continue learning, continue pushing themselves in new ways. But it is a standard. It's a really good standard. And, you know, all horse owners should want their farriers to be able to exhibit the basic knowledge that our certification requires, both in a written exam and also in a practical exam. So that's really what we're most known for. We also have an annual convention that provides continued continuing education and the National Forging and Horseshoeing Competition. We have a network of chapters nationwide. We currently have 51 chapters nationwide that we recommend young farriers, especially, but all farriers join to start developing that network. And all of those chapters offer certifications and clinics and contests and really provide a terrific resource, boots on the ground locally for farriers. And then also, you know, we work hard at providing ongoing education via videos, via our print magazine, No Foot, No Horse, and just really strongly encourage, as you said at the beginning, an elevation of the professionalism of farriers in the industry.
So there's been a misperception, I think sometimes, Martha, that being a farrier is like being licensed like a barber or some other profession. Mm-hmm. And others have said to me, nope, anybody can sort of hang out a shingle and claim to be a farrier. They don't have to prove any credentials. Talk to us a little bit about how that works.
That's absolutely spot on, Julie, and in many cases can be alarming. But currently, there is an absence of federal regulation in the trade. So what that means is that anyone could go to, even if it was a very, very brief training program, there are some programs out there as short as 2 weeks long, two more extensive, and then buy tools and call himself or herself a farrier. And, you know, there is no set license. There is no anything that you meet. So, you know, again, we feel like the AFA helps to fill that void. There are other organizations out there also working to do the same. But we sort of step in and hope that we can, in the absence of any sort of regulation, at least provide, you know, a very healthy standard of care. So the more farriers that we can encourage to go through certification, the better. But yeah, there is nothing requiring that right now in the United States.
So I'm just going to add to my question, Emily. So farriers have a unique skill set. Some of them do just what I call podiatry and hoof care. Others do maybe dental work or do other things. Is there any kind of formula for how that works, Martha or Travis?
I think I'd better kick that to Travis.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think there are a lot of farriers out there in the country, in the U.S., that do a multitude of things. I mean, we quoted that number of farriers that are in the U.S., but I'm not sure how many of them are full-time, how many of them are part-time, how many have a second job, how many just trim and shoe horses on the weekends, but many of them do multiple things. I mean, for example, here in my area, I've got a horse trainer who's also a farrier and does a wonderful job, but he splits his time up. I mean, to be honest with you, I'm probably in the part-time group now. I also work as the hospital administrator here at the college and as well as shoe horses. So I think farriers are a very diverse group with a lot of different interests and a lot of different skill sets. And so many of them use that to their advantage to carve out a niche in the market.
Gotcha. Okay.
I feel like, so going back to kind of the education and continuing education, like the horse's hoof hasn't changed in 5 million years. So in terms of continuing education, what does that look like? Like what are topics farriers choose to continue their education in? What helps to like keep fresh and what kind of continuing research is happening out there? And this question could be for both of you too. Travis, if you want to start.
Sure, I can go first. I think there's a lot of continuing education opportunities out there, and there are a lot of innovations out there. So we use a term called modern materials very loosely, but it is the horse's hoof care is constantly evolving. So maybe the horse's hoof hasn't changed from an anatomical structure as much during that time, but the materials and the products that we're able to put onto the horse's feet have changed. And a lot of the disease pathologies that the horse experiences has changed. You know, at one time, you know, horses, an old horse would be considered, a 15-year-old horse would be considered to be a really old horse. But now with modern advances in healthcare and what I would argue advances in the farrier profession, you know, they live 25, 30, 35 years. And as they go on in age, obviously, just like humans in the healthcare industry, more and more disease pathologies become apparent. So a lot of the CE events revolve around disease pathologies like navicular disease, laminitis. I mean, their entire conference is held on laminitis because the research and our knowledge on what laminitis is, how it happens, how to treat it, what are the comorbidities associated with it, are constantly advancing. And then I think a lot of the hoof care things that we put on, whether you want to call them orthotics or horseshoes or whatever, they're constantly changing. So most shoes are obviously made still of metal, aluminum and steel, but there's a lot of different variations that are being made now with urethanes. I mean, we have the ability to 3D print horseshoes and attach them now. So it's remarkable. There's a lot of things that are continuing to advance. And I think our research and our understanding of the equine hoof, the equine gait, and the disease pathologies that affect the hoof and the distal limb are constantly evolving and advancing. And fairs should absolutely be involved in the continuing education of that.
It's interesting. In my career with horses, I've had a lot of different farriers. And the one that I've used most recently, he always x-rayed and did radiographs. He looked at the angles. He did what I thought was a very sophisticated analysis before he even began to shoe the horse at all. And so technology has come so far, Travis. I'm wondering, are there other new instruments or new products that you guys are starting to integrate into, you know, your whole strategy for shoeing?
I think I can speak for me personally. We incorporate a lot of alternative forms of attachment. So, you know, obviously the majority of horseshoes are nailed on, but quite frankly, a lot of the horses that present here to the college to us have some disease pathology or some reason for it. But we do attach a lot of horseshoes here with adhesives. And the adhesives that are on the market are very good. It's relatively easy to be able to attach or glue on a horseshoe nowadays, which is really, really nice. It allows a lot of horses that maybe would have had to have time off or a break or not be able to keep their shoes on, the ability to keep going. But I think the single biggest thing that has changed the farrier profession, the vet farrier team, and the podiatry field, if you will, is exactly what you mentioned, digital radiography. You know, at one time, obviously, it was quite difficult. It was uncommon, honestly, to radiograph feet. So you would go out, radiograph the feet, go back, develop the film, then you had to come back, make changes, corrections, re-radiograph, go run the film and come back. But now, I mean, it's almost like taking a picture on your phone. There's battery operated generators, plates. You can see the image. You can see the inside of the horse's foot almost instantaneously there on the computer, and you can adjust your trim. You can trim a little bit, re-radiograph, see what it looks like. You can apply a shoe, check its placement, see if you like it, if that is aligned with the plan that you had biomechanically for that horse or not, and make adjustments in real time.
So going back to kind of the technology aspect of this, Martha, kicking this back to kind of the continuing ed stuff, how does that play into any education or training that AFA does?
Oh, thanks. I think that's a great question. We particularly try to pick that up at our annual convention, especially I would say over the last few years. I'm going to use this term a little bit loosely, but we've evolved for our organization in that a couple of years ago, Travis offered a modern materials demonstration for the first time at, I believe that was the first time, right, Travis? Was that the first time?
At least in my recent memory. Yeah. I mean, okay. Maybe before my time, but.
Okay. So definitely the first time in a while anyway. And then, you know, this year he's going to be doing that again, in addition to a wet lab where participants can come and have hands-on experience with that. And then certainly, you know, we bring in vet farriers. We bring in vets every time, and they share with our audience, you know, the technology that's out there, how to effectively use it, that kind of thing. So that's really our best bet to sort of continue bringing that to our members. And then, of course, via our print materials and our educational resources online, we try to keep, you know, that pretty diverse for them.
Hey, so you've led me to a question that I had on the back of my mind. So some people call the farrier first, and then the farrier might say, this is beyond me. You might need a veterinarian. Some people call the veterinarian first, and the veterinarian says, well, you really need a really good farrier to come help you out with this. Talk a minute, Travis, about that rapport and that relationship, that partnership between the farrier and the veterinarian, because that seems to me like collaborating and communicating between those two parties is just essential to coming up with the right solution and the right formula to ensure that what you're doing is going to improve the health and welfare of the horse.
Absolutely. You know, I think there really is that team dynamic. I think you hit the nail on the head that it is probably one of the more important things in that horse's life from a preventative healthcare standpoint is to have the vet and the farrier on the same page. And to be honest with you, sometimes that area, who to call and when to call, can get a little gray. And unfortunately, it can be a little uncomfortable. And so that's why I think it's really, really important for them to have a good collaborative relationship and be able to work well together. Because a lot of the issues they'll deal with, you really need both.
Are there veterinary farriers? Like, are there vets that are also certified or, you know, affiliated mm-hmm. as farriers?
Yeah, no, there's quite a few veterinarians that are also farriers, or maybe they were farriers and then went to vet school. Or maybe, for example, we have a vet student here, got into vet school and then got the interest in farrier and went on to farrier school later on. You know, it's becoming more and more common for there to be an individual who is both. And then obviously there's still a lot of the teams out there working together, the vet and the farrier.
So don't know if I said this at the top of the interview, but yesterday I was at the Marion DuPont Scott Virginia Tech Equine Medical Center. I hope I got that right.
It's a mouthful.
But I was talking to the group, and Dr. Mike and I were talking to the group about the veterinary shortage. And mm-hmm. someone in the audience asked me, were we also seeing a farrier shortage? Are fewer people going into farrier practice? Because everybody knows that we're really struggling to find enough veterinarians, especially in rural communities. And it occurred to me as we were chatting through this, are we feeling the same pinch in the farrier world?
To be honest, I don't know. I haven't seen those numbers or have a real good finger on a pulse of that. I mean, I can speak just personally in our area. We've had several retire in the last 5 years, and then we've had several new ones move into the area. So here in our region, I don't really see a shortage. Mm-hmm. One thing that I've noticed over probably the last 10, 15 years of my career that I think is analogous to the vet profession is the makeup of the farrier student population. You see more and more female students in the mm-hmm. entering the farrier schools and entering the profession, which was a similar phenomenon you saw in the vet profession.
It's amazing to me to think about that, Travis, because mm-hmm. people generally have the impression that farrier work is extremely physical. It's extremely hard on the body. So to see more women go into it is kind of fascinating. I know everybody seemed to think at one point most of the veterinarians in the community were men, and now I think the large majority are women. So there's an interesting transition that's going on in the both of those professions.
And I'm just kind of thinking about that, the pipeline for being a farrier. So when I was growing up, you know, there were some farrier schools, but as you went and apprenticed with your local farrier and you apprenticed with them for, you know, who knows how long before you felt comfortable going off on your own. And the area I'm in, that's still a very common way for people to learn to be a farrier. Is that apprentice pipeline kind of still active, do you guys think, with all the different school options there are now? Martha, maybe do you have any thoughts on that with mm-hmm. AFA?
Yeah, sure. I would be happy to take that one. So, you know, I think it is still very, very viable. And I think, you know, there's even people entering the field that don't go to school and go directly into apprenticing for someone. You know, we offer, I'd say, honestly, Emily, we probably have between 18 and 25 schools listed on our website at any given time. And I'd say there's probably several more that are out there operating that maybe we're not even aware of. But nearly all of those, and particularly the ones that are on our website, we know that they do encourage as a next step, you know, not that once you graduate, you're fully skilled up and tuned up and ready to go out on your own, but that what you are is ready to go perform as an apprentice. And many of them, that's part of the service that they provide to their students is placement into an apprenticeship upon graduation.
So if I'm looking to go to farrier school, does AFA list any sort of like accreditations for farrier schools? How do I know I'm going to a real one? And I put that in quotes and not just some guy in his backyard with a hammer and an anvil.
That's a great question. And, you know, so obviously we do believe that the ones that we share on our website are good programs. We do strongly advise everyone to do their own research. You know, we also encourage that you attend the school of an appropriate duration that you can still afford, because there are some very short programs out there. So the longer that you can go and immerse yourself in the trade, the better. But, you know, for the most part, it's about doing your research and learning the farrier credentials in general will help you. I mean, that helps you across the board in the industry. But certainly, if you're entering the field, learn about the owner operator and where that person has come from, how that person's career has gone. And then you sort of make the right choice, whether that's geographical or what you're able to afford or what have you, make the right choice in that way.
Point out one thing. So folks don't get the wrong impression. We're not picking on farriers and how they go through the process, because we see the same challenges in horse trainers, for example. We see a lot of other professions in our industry where there's not this clear pathway to how you become recognized for your qualifications and your training curriculum. So it's not just about farriers, but it's interesting that there are, in observation, there are more avenues for people to go to a farrier school or to find a way to do that than in maybe some other aspects of our industry. What do you think, Emily?
Yeah, I mean, just coming from, you know, an educator background, having opportunities of like a formal education outside of an apprenticeship, I think is so great for a lot of learners, especially if you want to get into it. And I think it can make networking easier, oddly enough, and expose you to more types of farriers and more types of needs. I don't know. That's just kind of how I view it as an educator. You know, I love school. I would be a professional student if that was an option. But I think it's really interesting, because I think if I knew more about going to farrier school if I was 17 or 18, I probably would have seriously considered that.
Travis, I'm curious, since Emily kind of opened this door, do farriers tend to specialize in one breed or the other? I mean, do they get in a groove and say, hey, I know how to really shoe, I don't know, saddlebreds well, let me stick with that? or do they do multiple breeds?
Yeah, I think there's a wide array there, but I think it's becoming more and more commonplace for farriers to specialize in one discipline or one breed. I mean, even just generically breaking up into gated horse farriers and non-gated horse farriers, and then English farriers and Western farriers. I think that's becoming more and more commonplace, because obviously the sports are getting more and more complicated. The horses are getting better and better at it. And every tiny little detail matters in the performance horse world. And so being able to really immerse yourself in those worlds and fully understand what is asked of that horse or that horse rider combination, and be able to be a member of that team and contribute.
Martha, I was just going to ask, so like, if I'm looking for a farrier on the AFA website, do they list any specialties and breeds or disciplines on there?
You know, oftentimes they do, Emily. Not everyone. The Find a Farrier directory is an optional opt-in or not. And then sometimes, you know, someone will build out his or her own profile. I think if you actually put in Travis, you would actually see what a fully built out profile looks like. But then they can put in like their own specialties. They can also ask us to do so if they would like to. We're happy to do that for them. But it really depends on the individual farrier and what they've sort of uploaded as their public profile.
I'm going to go spy on my farrier and see if he's in there.
Hey, so I have a two-part question. My first question is, how often should someone's farrier check out their horse? How often should a horse typically, you know, see their farrier? And the second part I really want Travis to weigh in on is, we find through our research that when money gets tight, there's extenuating circumstances, owners feel like maybe farrier is something they can postpone. They tend to stretch out the visits between them. And I'm just wondering, what are the long-term flaws in that thinking? Travis, talk a minute about that.
Yeah, no, I'd be happy to. I think most horses, a typical shoeing cycle is somewhere between 4 and 8 weeks. So, or the time in between farrier visits. And there's lots of things that affect that from the season. The time of year obviously changes the rate of growth for the horse's hoof, depending on that horse's discipline, what they're doing. It may change that cycle. Some horses just grow feet really faster than other horses. So there's a lot of variety or variation there. But I think 4 to 8 weeks is a common trimming shoeing cycle for the majority of horses. But I do agree with you. I think when money gets tight, the farrier care is one of the things that is neglected or let go. And I mean, and financial constraints do make that choice a reality. And oftentimes, you know, owners have to make that decision. I am obviously biased being a farrier, but I think it is imperative for the overall preventative health care of the horse to maintain their farrier care. So if the horse's hoof goes longer, then that increases the lever arms around the distal limb, you know, making the risk for injury to the soft tissue structures of the horse's body more common. It predisposes them to things like white line disease, cracking, things like that. And so I think it's really, really important to maintain farrier care when possible, but obviously we know economics play a role there.
Yep. And I just want to make a point too. So, you know, when we've traveled around talking about access to economic issues with access to horse care, and when we've spoken with veterinarians about it, we've had vets, you know, we have like two levels of vets. One section of vets will say, well, I don't see an issue with this. This isn't really an issue of cost impacting care. And then we have another set of vets that'll say, oh, no, we see this all the time in our clients. And we kind of have this dichotomy, right, of like two different tiers of horse owners. So I'm sure if there's any farriers listening out there, that I'm sure some are saying, you know, I don't really see this. I don't see this as an issue. And then there's those of us kind of operating on the other side where, yes, there's definitely owners out there who maybe that $60, maybe that $150 for that month really needs to be spent on some human care and, you know, pushing that horse out another 6 weeks if they're barefoot doesn't seem like that big of a deal in the moment in light of, okay, I can shoe the horse or I can go to the food pantry, you know? So it is a real issue, I think, even if you're not necessarily seeing it in your area of the horse world every day. So I just want to put that out there for everybody listening to this who might be thinking like, no, I don't really see this as an issue. That we do see it in the rescue world a lot, that delay of care is a big welfare issue that stems directly from owner financial struggles. So, Julie, do we want to take this as a moment to segue?
Yes, we do indeed. So I'm going to build off of that. So the American Horse Council and the United Horse Coalition and the American Farriers Association are so excited to announce that we're launching a new program called Farrier Direct. It's built around the same model that we have with the American Association of Equine Practitioners, AAEP, for their Vet Direct. So if there is an owner who finds themselves suddenly in some kind of personal crisis and their finances are tight or there's something that's going on in their life and they need some assistance through Farrier Direct, the American Farrier Association members can apply to get reimbursed for services for their clients up to $300 per horse. And we're really excited about this program because through all of our research at the American Horse Council, we have found veterinary care and farrier care are two of the really essential things that people who get in this crisis situation are struggling with. The United Horse Coalition, as most people know, has a resource database where you can find hay banks and feed coupons and all kinds of resources to help you if you're struggling. And we're so excited about continuing this whole mission of offering resources for people who find themselves in those circumstances. So Vet Direct is out there. You can contact AAEP to learn more about that. And definitely reach out to the American Horse Council or the American Farriers Association to learn more about Farrier Direct.
And I want to add something about how it works. So we think this is a really important model of program because instead of owners who might be embarrassed reaching out and asking for help, this is about help happening at the point of care. So the service provider, the farrier in this case, is in charge of deciding if this owner needs help. So say you're a farrier and you've had a client who keeps kind of texting you to reschedule last minute and they're being kind of vague about it, and you check in with them and you realize because they just don't have the funds, it's your prerogative as the farrier of you can apply through AFA for the funds. And so it's just kind of a blanket grant as long as what that owner needs. So general farrier care, some other odds and ends in terms of shoeing. It doesn't cover veterinary care, so that would need to go through Vet Direct. But the farrier, the professional with the knowledge and the relationship with the client, has kind of the power in the situation to make a difference.
Yeah. So if you're a farrier out there, please be sure and reach out to Martha and the American Farriers Association. If you're a member of theirs, to apply to be part of the program, that's going to be the key. Not just any farrier can be part of the program. They have to be an AFA member. We want to ensure that these farriers are well-trained and very knowledgeable and are in a position to make really informed decisions when they apply for this additional assistance to help these clients. So we're really excited about that. Thank you, Martha, so much for your collaboration and your work with us. And Travis, we have so appreciated all of your insights and your knowledge and your assistance and all the work that you've done with the American Horse Council over a number of different topics.
Well, thank you, Julie. We're very excited from an AFA perspective to have this partnership and this project with you, and in particular, such a meaningful project that we're able to work on, and appreciate your time today very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you guys very much. I think this is a great, great partnership, and ultimately it's the horse that's going to benefit, and that's the best thing. That's the reason we're all here.
Goal. Exactly, exactly. Yep. So thank you both. Have a great rest of your day.
The American Horse Council, AHC, United Horse Coalition, UHC, and American Farriers Association, AFA, are excited to announce the launch of Farrier Direct. Farrier care is one of the top unaffordable services during personal crises, such as job loss, divorce, illness, or natural disaster. Through Farrier Direct, U.S.-based AFA members can apply to be reimbursed for services for clients in need up to $300 per horse. Services such as regular trimming, shoeing, abscess or thrush care, as well as emergency shoe replacement, would all qualify for appropriate services for reimbursement. To find out more, the link will be posted in the show notes. This program is designed to support owners experience temporary hardship and to keep horses with their humans.
So our legislative and regulatory update for this episode is all about agritourism. Agritourism is one of those terms that sounds complicated, but it's actually pretty straightforward. It simply means that you're inviting the public onto a working farm for activities or education or recreation or entertainment that's connected with agriculture.
And as we love to tell everybody, horses absolutely count as agriculture in most states. So if you're boarding, breeding, training, or raising horses on a farm, you are part of agriculture. And many horse operations are already doing agritourism without realizing it.
Well, that's exactly accurate, Emily. Riding lessons, camps, trail rides, pony parties, clinics, school visits, photo sessions, farm tours, all those can fall under agritourism.
And we're also seeing farms expand to do things like weddings and corporate retreats, wellness programs, and farm stays. And there's a lot of creativity happening, kind of driven by this whole economic agriculture kind of ecosystem.
Yep. Horse farms operate on really tight margins. We all know that. Feed, land, labor, insurance costs continue to rise. Agritourism can provide a diversified income stream that can help a farm stay financially sustainable instead of relying on just one source of revenue like boarding or training.
And I always like this part. There's this community connection piece that's really valuable. So a lot of people today, and we talk about this is an issue in the horse world in general, are kind of generations removed from participating in agriculture. So getting people to visit your farm, maybe their only direct experience with farming or livestock or horses in general.
And that creates understanding and appreciation, which we really need. When people see firsthand the care and the commitment involved in horse ownership, it really builds trust Emily and I talk a lot in public settings about public trust and social license to operate or social license to thrive, and exposing people to the horse community through agritourism builds that kind of trust that we really want to kind of grow on.
Yeah. And so it's important to mention that agritourism isn't just opening your gate and hoping people show up. There's legal issues, zoning issues, like Julie said, insurance issues and safety considerations that farms need to understand.
Yeah. And one of the biggest areas is, of course, in liability protection. Most states have equine activity liability laws, and many also have agritourism liability statutes that provide certain protections if the farms follow requirements by posting signage or using waivers. So you need to check that out.
And at the federal level, this is where it gets a little exciting. There's also growing recognition of agritourism's importance. So recent discussions in the Farm Bill and rural development programs have included specific agritourism language as part of economic diversification for farms. And there have also been bipartisan proposals in recent years aimed at improving access to funding and grants and risk management tools for agritourism businesses.
Yeah, and this is something that the American Horse Council continues to monitor, and we advocate around making sure that horse farms are included when agricultural policy is developed. We have great partnerships with a number of different organizations that focus on rural communities and agriculture, and we all really try to row in the same direction to ensure that we have these kinds of opportunities.
And that's just at the federal level. So another piece that sometimes surprises farm owners is how much agritourism is influenced at the local government level.
Yeah, so that gets into the zoning thing, which is a big factor. Some counties and municipalities typically control land use, which means they decide what types of activities are allowed on agricultural properties. Some communities clearly allow agritourism and they promote agritourism, while others may require special permits or conditional use approvals or some kind of event license.
And this can vary really dramatically from one town to the next, even within the same state. So a horse farm might be allowed to host lessons and camps by right, but weddings or large public events could trigger additional requirements like parking plans or traffic management, restroom facilities, occupancy limits, that kind of stuff.
They even get into noise ordinances and signage rules and building codes can all just be part of this equation. And that's why it's really important for farm owners to talk with your local planning or zoning or your zoning office early before you invest any money into new agritourism activities.
And the good news is that many communities are becoming more supportive because agritourism contributes to local economies. It preserves farmlands and brings visitors into rural areas as well.
Yeah. And in some cases, state agritourism laws actually limit how much local governments can restrict farm-based activities, which can help provide clarity for horse operations. And I'll give you a couple of great examples, Emily. I know in the Virginia area where I live, there are many wineries, and now they have expanded and they have all types of education. They have events on Fridays and Saturday nights. So they're taking advantage of that agritourism thing. And as we get ready to embark on the new national economic impact study for the horse industry in the coming years, we're going to be trying to get a better understanding of how tourism and agritourism comes into play for the horse industry.
Yes, definitely. And it's kind of a new thing for us. So we'll see how it plays out. And because it's new, another really key piece to remember is insurance. And I know we talk about insurance for a lot of things, but not all farm policies automatically cover public visitors or events. So it's really important to talk with your insurance provider, especially someone who understands your equine operation.
Yeah, and I don't need to preach to the choir here because we all know risk management becomes an issue. You know, horses are great, but they're really big. And clear visitor guidelines and trained staff and safe facility designs and all those kinds of things that really structure the interactions between visitors who aren't accustomed to being around horses need in order to minimize risk that's there.
And the thing is, when agritourism is done well, it can be really, really rewarding. So many farm owners love being that person to introduce new people to horses and just seeing their faces light up and watching that first connection happen.
That moment never gets old. Emily, I can honestly say at the Horse Council, we often co-host events with the DC Metro Police or with the local caisson platoon down on the National Mall. And it's amazing to me the visitors that are down on the mall that have never interacted with a horse, and they are just amazed when they get the opportunity to stand next to the horse, have their picture made, maybe pet the horse, learn the horse's story. And that's not quote unquote agritourism, but boy, it sure helps our industry.
If you've ever had that moment of being a horse ambassador for someone for the first time, it's just awesome. So the question is agritourism right for every horse farm? And the answer is not necessarily. So it depends on your goals and your facilities and your capacity. And some farms prefer to remain private, and that's totally fine.
But for farms that are interested, starting small is often the best approach we can advise. Maybe you host an open house, or you partner with a local school, or you offer a seasonal event. You don't have to build a major event venue overnight in order to take part in agritourism.
And one big trend we're seeing is that people want authentic experiences. Mm-hmm. So they want to connect with animals and nature and rural life. So horse farms are really uniquely positioned to kind of meet that demand.
Yep. And there's also a really great advocacy benefit from all this. Visitors become supporters. We see this in the equine assisted services field, where they often invite people to come in and see what kind of services and therapeutic things that they offer. And those people become donors and supporters and become sidewalkers and do all those other things. So the more people understand land use and animal care and the value of the equine industry, the better off we all are.
And so before we wrap up, kind of the quick takeaway is, if you're a horse farm owner and you're curious about where to start with agritourism, ask yourself these questions. So what experience could you safely offer? Who is your target or your local audience? And what regulations apply in your area?
And I'll just add, what do you want your farm to feel like? Agritourism works best when it matches your farm culture and your personal goals.
Yes. And so for more resources and to learn more, as always, you can visit the American Horse Council website or shoot us an email at info@horsecouncil.org.
And a shameless plug, at our conference this year in June, which is in Washington, D.C., we're going to have a panel discussion on agritourism. So we invite you to come and be part of that conversation, too. Well, thank you for joining us today. We'll provide more numbers and links in our show notes. We invite you to support our beloved horse industry and join the American Horse Council. You can earn a free subscription to our monthly newsletter and to other publications that we offer. We share the latest in all our legislative happenings, federal and state, as well as more information that we think horse owners like you would need to know.
And you can follow the American Horse Council on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, X, formerly Twitter, and LinkedIn. And you can also subscribe to this podcast's RSS feed. You can subscribe to Horses in the Morning on any podcast player and find all the shows, including ours, on the Horse Radio Network at horseradionetwork.com.
And as we like to say, we are #HereForHorses.